Well, good to all, and all of us who are here today, good to see you, and those watching from home, we're glad that you can be here. I'm going to talk a little bit about grief. I'm going to come back to the subjects of the covenants that and the things we can learn from the covenants God has made with people. But in the last year, obviously, pretty much all of you know that, you know, I've been cared for my wife, and then we had a memorial a week ago, and you know, it's been almost a month now, just short of a few days when she passed away. And so in that process, though, of the last year, I have been reading a lot about grief. I've been talking to a number of people. Obviously, in the last 6 months, we had hospice and had regular visits from chaplains and social workers, and talked with them different times, talked with a number of family members and others, kind of caught up in different, you know, having to care for a loved one, like, you know, basically having to be a caretaker, you know, around the clock, and the toll that takes and the grief that you go through in that process. So I've talked to a lot of people, and I've been kind of planning this and do some lessons about it. Today will be kind of a standalone one, but just to kind of talk a little bit about kind of the biblical perspective of grief, and specifically understanding the difference between grief, mourning, and lamentation. And for a lot of us, we may not really know the difference of those things. They are different things in Scripture. And we do all of them, but sometimes we don't really know that. We don't really aren't aware of it. And so I'm going to kind of talk a little bit about it. And then at the end, I'm going to give a few suggestions. I have a lot of them, but I'm going to give a few probably at a time. If I do different lessons on it, I'll probably give some others. But, you know, just a few thoughts about things I've learned in the last year, either from just my own experience or from talking with others. And so, first off, I'll give you just my take on what grief is. Grief is often unique to each person, can be terribly lonely, even when grieving with others. And I'll stop there for just a moment. One of the things that I've learned is that I'm pretty acquainted with grief. I've talked to a lot of people in the last year. I've lost a lot of family. You know, when you're the baby of a large family, you're going to lose a lot of people by the time you get to 60 or so. So I lost my father 28 years ago, roughly. Lost a sister about 23 years ago. Lost a nephew who was brutally murdered just about 10 years ago. You know, lost my mother, I guess it's been now 2 years, and then I lost another brother I lost just not quite 2 years ago. And so that's, you know, besides that, Julie and I lost a baby early in our marriage. And so pretty acquainted with grief. I've gone through it a lot. But the thing is, every one of them is different. And partly because my relationship is different with all of them. And so, for example, when my sister, who passed away, you know, not long after Janae was born, we had been a little bit on the outs. Had some issues between us. And, you know, that was hard to see her pass away so suddenly. But you know, it's one thing, you know, after visiting and going back home and seeing her buried and the funeral and everything else, I traveled back home to Arizona, got back to my normal life. And I kept going on with living my regular life, which wasn't hard because nothing about my regular life had changed. And so it was sad, but and then, you know, after years go by and it's kind of hard to see and understand why my mother couldn't move on like some of us. And now I get it better, because that's her daughter. She's never going to be the same, right? I mean, I lost an older sibling. She was just a bit older than me. And hard, sad, but my life pressed on. My life didn't really change. But my mom's was never the same, right? And when my nephew, which was my sister who died, oldest boy, when he was killed, my mother, it affected her dramatically. It was her grandson, right? She had tons of them. I have a lot of nieces and nephews. I mean, I think when I was in eighth grade, I was on a field trip, like a week-long field trip somewhere, and my parents, one of my siblings had a child, and they got a hold of, called into this place that I was staying at with, you know, teachers and stuff, and they got the message to them, and a teacher comes and tells me I have a grandchild, you know, I think it was a nephew, and I was like, oh, okay, and it's like at that point I still had like 15 of them. I'm like, I now I got 16, and like not that big of a deal to me. It's like I'm already, you know, babysitting all the time, so you know, that's just another one. But for my mother, that's a totally different relationship, and so that grief is different. And so the interesting thing is that I've learned, one of the things that makes grief unique for every individual and why it's often very lonely, is even if everybody is grieving, not everybody is grieving the same, and they're not grieving in the same kind of way all at the time. So you're not always sharing the exact same emotions at every moment and everything, and not everything hits you the same way. And it's just very, very unique and very different. And so a lot of this is things I've learned, not only from experience, but from being taught. But grief, as people often talk about stages of grief, and I'm going to give a quote here in a little bit from the person who created that concept. And it isn't stepping through a process like going upstairs. Sometimes it's talked about that, like the stages of grief are just, okay, you go through this stage and this stage and this stage, and they're talked about that way. And the person who created it does not think that, never thought that. That is a abuse of the concept. And so it is much more like taking a handful of strings, okay, of emotional yarn, jumbling them and tangling them into a ball, and having you kind of weave in and out of all of those things on a regular basis. That's what grief really is. And that's how she saw it. She just identified these initially five. Now a lot of people identify seven stages. But they're not a stepping thing, and there's not a there's not an appropriate time to be done. There's a reason for that we're going to get into. But grief is often commensurate with our connection to the one we lose. How close we are, how much people will say sometimes how much you love them. A lot of times we love people, but we're not near them all the time, right? And so when we lose them, we're saddened, we hurt, and it affects us, but then it didn't change anything in our life. But then others change everything, right? And so losing a spouse has changed everything for me. It's very different. Now, I didn't just lose her a month ago. I lost her really in many ways, in bits by bits, over the last year. But and so little more of her each kind of stage that happened. Our relationship changed. Everything changed in the house. I've told people a number of times. One of the reasons I have a bunch of furniture that I offered people was because I had to rearrange the whole house for her at least four times for safety reasons and other issues. And so going through that process. So I've been grieving in a lot, even since we first heard about it and coming back last year, her cancer. But even from the time she got cancer we learned about it in 18. There's a certain amount of grief there as well, a certain amount of fear that sets in. And so there's all of those things playing a role. And so how close and connected you are to somebody is often going to affect the depth and length of your grief. But understand that grief is not simply death. So I could hear it in Dave's voice talking up here about his kids being deployed to Afghanistan for a year. There's grief there, There's worry there. There's sadness and sorrow and all of these different things because they're not going to see them. Now, a little bit of contact now with our current technology, but they're still gone and they're still in a very dangerous place, doing dangerous work. And so that causes worry. It causes sorrow and it causes pain. Because in the Bible, the term grief is used in a lot of different ways for a lot of different kinds of pain. It's not only emotional sorrow, but physical pain as well as sin. The idea of grieving properly over sin is also important. And so the idea of understanding our own failures affects our grief. And so grief is not something to be fixed. Grief is an emotion that you simply experience. And you experience it as long as you experience it, right? It's no different than how you experience sadness at times, or how you experience joy at times, or how you experience love. There's no proper length of time for those things. They just are what they are, and they're appropriate emotions. And so, the thing that people who are grieving need is not somebody to fix it, but somebody to simply comfort them, love them, and give them presence with a C and not a T. Okay. And so that's why stuff doesn't matter that much when you're talking about grief. It is about personal connections that matter. So, couple of things here. The lady, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, was a psychiatrist and the originator of the five stages concept. This is actually a quote from her from a book that I have and have read. It says, the five stages, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, are a part of the framework that makes up our learning to live with the one we lost. They are tools to help us frame and identify what we may be feeling. They are not stops on some linear timeline in grief. And some psychologists even talk about it. Like if you're still doing it after a year or two, that's inappropriate. And that concept was never done by the original people who came up with this idea that we go through all these different kind of conflicting emotions. That grief, the emotion of grief, has a lot of other emotions in it and connected to it. And so that's the concept of steps isn't there. So I gave you my best analogy, the yarn, ball of yarn, of a lot of different threads in it. So hopefully maybe you can come up with a different one. Another psychologist had mentioned grief is only love. It's nothing to hide or send away with happy pills. This is why it doesn't need to be fixed. Do you need to fix people's sadness? Do you need to fix their love or their missing of another person? No. Well, when it comes to emotions, we don't think of having to fix people's emotions. We think sometimes of having to fix grief, but it's just another emotion. And it's connected, as this psychologist talks about, she talks about it in ways that it is commensurate, comparable to how much you love. And so your grief is going to be how big your love is going to, your grief's going to be that big too. So, and then the lady who wrote the particular book, who's a counselor and authored this particular book called Grief Day by Day, I firmly believe that the depth of our grief measures the height of our love, she wrote. And then just to kind of Proverbs 14:13. There are a lot of passages, by the way, that talk about grief. I'm not going to really talk about all of them, but it brought in this proverb because I think it highlights the idea of the connection to emotions and how it's just kind of another part of the emotions. It says, even in laughter, the heart may ache. And the end of joy may be grief. And so you can have joy, but then that ends in grief, just like we can have laughter that ends in heartache. And there are these opposite things, and that life is kind of full of this stuff. Life has these ups and downs to it. It has these ups and downs emotionally for us, because that's just what happens. We can't stop people from leaving this world. That's not possible. Probably not even what we would really want. We really want to leave this place and go to a better place, because this world isn't that great. Sometimes. Now, sometimes we like it. Sometimes there are things we enjoy about it, but it is full of sorrow. That's why our Lord has talked about being acquainted with sorrows. He's taken our griefs upon him. Okay. And so, in order to wipe away all the tears so that there is no more sorrow, right? So that there's no more grieving because you're not losing them anymore. That's his plan. That's his goal. Now, I'm going to talk about mourning a little bit. Because a lot of times we think of them as very much like synonyms. But the term mourning, especially in Scripture, does not mean grief in that emotional sense. It actually refers to the expressions of grief. And so some of the expressions you might have noticed, you've been here for the last month, you'll notice that I have... Whether I come to your house or you've seen me out, you know, I have primarily been wearing black when I have left my house. I have made those decisions every time I left my house to wear black. And I've done that. I'm going to do that for 30 days. Is that, we see that as kind of an example. There's a few different lengths of time for how long mourning periods were given. One of them for Moses, we'll see here in a bit, was 30 days. For Aaron, it was also 30 days. But for Joseph, it was 70 days that Egypt actually mourned for him. But they had 40 days for embalming him and 30 days for mourning him. But then on the other hand, you have Aaron, the high priest. When God killed his two sons, Nadab and Abihu, and killed them in the courtyard of the tabernacle, he did not allow him to do mourning rituals, any expressions of his grief. And because he was the high priest, he was anointed, he was representing God at that point. Now, they said they let the people do it. Aaron couldn't. But Aaron being told by God he couldn't mourn is not telling Aaron he couldn't feel grief. Those are not the same things. He was not supposed to show grief. And so I'll give you just a couple of things. Deuteronomy 34:8, this is after Moses had died. The people of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended. Now, how many of you can just control your weeping, say, okay, I'll weep today. And then tomorrow, no more weeping tomorrow. We don't think about weeping that way, right? Because very often we weep or cry more just when it hits us. And so over the last month, there have been a lot of things that will make me cry. And I really don't know when they will be, when they will hit. I might say something, or I might talk about something, or I might watch something that will just make me cry. It's not, there's no connection to all of them. Like, oh, well, I'm remembering Julie. No, I remember Julie a lot without crying. But then sometimes I cry. And it's just the way it is. I really don't control that. So what they're talking about here, they did it for 30 days and then they stopped. You've probably seen it. Pictures of people wailing publicly, especially like screaming out in sorrow and pain, you know, they lost a child. It's very, very common in some countries and not as much in others. In Middle East countries, you see it all the time. You see a screaming and wailing that will happen. It is culturally kind of expected that that's what they do. And they will do that publicly for a period of time, and then they won't do it anymore. And this is a very ancient practice. So mourning are the rituals that we go through to express and demonstrate to the public our grief. So a lot of them, people don't see anymore because we don't, as our culture, a lot of our American don't have kind of an American practice that way. We might come from family backgrounds that have some of that, maybe have some cultures that we always do this or that in, when we're mourning. But it's not very American anymore to do it. People don't like to even go to memorials and funerals a lot. They want to just, I just want to celebrate their life. And celebration of life, by the way, is another thing of mourning. It's not, mourning isn't always just sadness. It's, mourning has to do with this idea of remembrance and praise and honor and a lot of stuff that is about talking about expressing the remembrance and the sorrow and the sadness. And so that's what they did for 30 days, and then they put it away. So like next week when I come, I will, for the first time in the last month, next Sunday, I will not be wearing my black suit. And that's just what I decided, a fairly long time ago. I had known that even before she passed, that's what I was going to do. But it's not the only thing, probably the one you could see. Some of you might see these two bracelets that I wear. One of them is actually a little Mickey bracelet, got from Disneyland years ago, that Julie had, and has some of her favorite colors in it. And the other one is a bracelet she got at the Rock store up in McCall on the time we were up there camping. And so I have worn them publicly, one or both publicly for pretty much the whole month as well. Probably even wear those longer than that. But it's also this watch. So this watch we bought on Valentine's Day, February 14th, in Disney World, when we were there, when we took her there for her last trip. And it says in it, so it's a, you look at it, oh, nice, gold watch, citizen watch. It says proof that Tony Stark has a heart. It's kind of made like the little thing he had in his chest. And in the card with it, it says, I love you 3000. And if you know the Endgame movie, you kind of might know the reference. That's what Tony Stark's daughter says to him before he leaves and eventually dies. But and so it has kind of, they all have significance to me, significance of her. So the idea of the expressions, though, and you, they're around us too. If you ever watch, most of you have probably seen It's a Wonderful Life, right? If you know the story of It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart's character, after his father passes and he's taking care of the old stupid building alone, he is in his coat, and his coat has a black armband on it. That was a public symbol to everybody that saw him that he was in mourning. And that's often what many of these symbols' purpose was, to let everybody else know they were mourning. And so how would you treat them? Why would you do public symbols of mourning if there wasn't an idea that want to have other people aware that that person's mourning? Not only that you might give them a little bit more leeway in sometimes how they are acting and responding, but that also you might be able to console and comfort. Right, so public expressions, and so some of them, it's just a Bible dictionary list. It had a list of them. I'll read the one stuff in yellow I highlighted. So they're expressed in weeping. So a couple of passages. By loud lamentation, which we're going to look at in a little bit. By the disfigurement of the person as rending the clothes. That they would, when somebody died, they would rip their clothes, whatever they were wearing. Wearing sackcloth. Now, I don't know exactly what sackcloth is, but I've worked in a grocery store in the produce section, and we got some stuff in big, burlap sacks. And I can't imagine trying to wear any of that kind of fabric as clothing, but that was part of its purpose, to wear something that had made a statement. And it wasn't comfortable. It wasn't for its, how wonderful it was, or for how great it felt. It was, it had some, irritant to it. But it had this reminder to it all the time. This clothing had a purpose. sprinkling dust or ashes on the person. So they would use dust and ashes on their heads or on their foreheads and different things. They might shave the head. They might pluck out the hair of their head or their beard. They might neglect their person or remove all ornaments. So they might, so it might be a woman that went without any jewelry at all of any type for a month. They might have removed all those things. They might have removed wearing perfumes, colognes, or doing anything. They might not have treated themselves normally for a period of time. They might have fasted. They might, and sometimes that happens without even thinking about it. I think it's why everybody wants to bring grieving, when people have somebody who dies, everyone wants to bring them food, right? And a lot of that, I'm guessing for a lot of the other people who get food when they're grieving after the loss of a loved one, they're having to give a lot of it away because you tend to not be that hungry, you know? And so need other people to come and help eat it up. But covering the upper lip, cutting the flesh. By the way, this was, God had told the Israelites not to do this practice. And also sitting in silence, which is why, you know, so sometimes if somebody was wearing some symbol that they were grieving and they were sitting around you and they were just not talking at all. How often are you weirded out by driving with somebody and them not talking at all for, like, say, the whole half hour or a whole hour trip? Would you be weirded out by that? I don't know how many of you would be weirded out by that. I wouldn't be weirded out by it all because that's common for me. my wife learned to not be weirded out by it when I was silent like that because just him doing that. In fact, my family learned, you know, Janae has to have to tell for us from time to time. In that whole hour, I might make a gesture, I might make a face, I might do something that is obvious that I'm having some conversation in my head, and they're like, and they learned to stop asking me what it is. I was like, well, there was like a dozen of them, so it's hard to parse it out for you in that one tiny split second. So I'm not bothered by that. I did notice, I think, driving around even with Janae last week or so, earlier this week, I just could hardly talk. You know, I just really had no desire to talk this last week, especially right after the memorial. I had the next couple of days probably. But these are all the ways we express it. And so God has actually kind of, we see in the scriptures, God telling us to express it for a period of time. And whether other people are aware or not, do it. Make that knowledge. Every single day I make the decision that I do something for her, to remember her. Now there will come the day when it will be time to set those things aside and keep going. But now's not that day yet. But that day comes sooner than we think. But when that day comes, it's time to put those symbols away and press on. It doesn't mean the grief goes away. It only means the outward expressions of letting everybody know you're in the process go away. So the emotions you're still going to feel and you're still going to go through for a long time. Because in many ways, as some psychologists talk about, you will never be the same. It will change you forever. Because just by loving somebody will change you forever, so will the losing of that somebody change you forever. Because that's the nature of having a connection with other people. Because if it didn't change you forever, it would mean you really didn't have a connection that was very strong. So, by the way, mourners, one of the ways you can see this, that mourners were often brought in to sing songs of lament and express tokens of sorrow. They were hired sometimes, even in Scripture. It's very, like, different from us. So we have, when somebody passes away, we have people that come in and take the body, prepare it for, you know, its end. They didn't do that. They prepared the body and hired mourners. And the mourners would come in, and they would be the people who would sing. And they would sing songs of lament. In fact, I think it's the 2 Chronicles 35 passage that talks about specifically needing to bring in the gifted, the mourning women and the gifted singers. Why? To sing songs of lament. We're going to talk about that here now. But that's also, you can only hire people to do something if it's something you can do without feeling it a great deal, right? In fact, in many ways, it's easier for singers if they're not connected, right? For a lot of us, last week, singing for Julie, for those really connected, some of those songs were really hard to get through. Now, Janae actually spent days going through them, listening to them, singing them, so she could desensitize herself because she was committed to honor her mother and sing them all. And she did a great job. But she had to work at it to get over that because it was hard. You know, I didn't do that. I couldn't get through all the songs. But that's sometimes why you would have mourners hired, because their job was simply to come in. We do this, by the way, memorials, funerals. There's lots of people there who are simply hired to practice and do the functions of the rituals of burying or remembering those who have passed on. So we do them. We often just don't recognize them for what God has talked about them. So what is lamenting? Lamenting is actually singing songs of remembrance, honor, praise, etc., about someone or of someone. And in fact, you know them. You know lamenting songs, not just some of the most famous ones. The most famous in Scripture is the one that David writes for Saul and Jonathan in 2 Samuel 1 from 17 through 27. And I'll put up a couple verses of it here in a minute. But there are others written in Scripture as well that are songs of lament. What they are is poetry that were meant to be sung. So they're songs, but you know some, and I'm gonna read the lyrics of one that I think everybody here knows if you're at least old enough. And it says, "A long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile, and I knew if I had my chance that I could make those people dance, and maybe they'd be happy for a while. But February made me shiver with every paper I'd deliver." Bad news on the doorstep. I couldn't take one more step. I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride. Something touched me deep inside the day the music died. And so bye-bye, Miss American Pie. I don't know if Don McLean meant that in his mind that he was writing a lament. Now, it's very possible that he knew he was writing a lament because that's what it is. The song is a lament written in the early 70s. About an event. It starts with the event of the plane crash that killed Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper. I don't remember his real name, but that is in the late 50s, if I remember right, in I think 59 or 60, I can't remember exactly which year. That was a long time before. The song goes on, it really is lamenting much of what happened in America all through the 60s. And for those of us who were alive at that time frame, and I've mentioned this before, the song, I think, really describes what it felt like to be an American in the early 70s. Now, for some of you, you're too young for that. So those of us who are older, I think it resonates just from, we may not understand every reference, but boy, we can kind of feel the feeling. It's like, man, it was a depressing time. You know, Watergate and Vietnam, and I mean, it was a depressing, depressing era in America's time. We've had others, as we yesterday celebrated 20 years of 9/11, another terribly depressing time in our history. And so that's when you write laments. And so that is what a lament is. And there's purpose behind them. And in fact, David told, when he wrote this lament, he instructed the whole tribe of Judah to learn it and sing it. What is the purpose of that? Why do we sing these songs? Like, you know, the hard one, that, you know, enter in. about somebody dying and God entering them into heaven. Well, when we sing that song, which a lot of us might remember singing for Don many years ago when he died, from brain cancer, and it's hard to get through because you're picturing them and you're these words and they hit. But why do we sing those? Because it is a way to express feelings that need to come out, that you need to not repress. Because the biggest thing about grief that you don't want to do is simply hide it and pretend it's not there. Pretend it's not real. Because I see it. I see it in some of the people close to me, some of the family and friends that I know who are struggling. And in some ways they're struggling because they keep running from the sorrow. They keep running from the pain. And they don't express it and talk about it and open up about it and express how they feel about it and express it in song or express it in words or express it in letter or whatever. They want to not have anything to do with it and they want to just like go have fun. Well, that's a recipe for getting stuck in a way that's unhealthy. So Amos 8 verse 10 says, I will turn your feasts into mourning and your songs into lamentation. I will bring sackcloth on every waist and baldness on every head. I will make it like the mourning for an only son and the end of it like a bitter day. He's talking about the nation of Israel and what God is going to do to them. And he says, it's going to be bad. Everybody's going to be mourning like it was your only son. And you're going to, all your songs will be lamentations. They won't be, songs of joy and happiness and having fun. They're going to be songs of remembrance and sorrow and sadness. 2 Samuel, the couple of verses here, 25 through 27, how the mighty have fallen. This is the lament that David wrote for Saul and Jonathan. This part of it is specifically about Jonathan. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. That phrase, by the way, is repeated in it, and it is kind of like the chorus. Essentially, Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. As is expressing David's feelings, and expresses them especially for Jonathan. I mean, he had feelings for Saul, but those were probably somewhat confused, since sometimes Saul loved him and sometimes Saul wanted to kill him. But Jonathan was always his, what we would say, BFF, right? He really was his best friend, and it was forever. Though they were closer even than he was to his wife or wives. Now, a few suggestions. And I said that this actually works for caregivers too. I say familial ones only because sometimes you're a caregiver. Hired caregivers are a little different. There's still a lot of stress on them. It's still a difficult job to be a hired caregiver. But when you're the caregiver who is connected to that person, that is a different type of caregiving. It is a different level of it because you're not only trying to do all that kind of job, that job is now completely intertwined into all of your emotions as well. And so it is a challenging. It is a grief-stricken time. And so the first suggestion is don't try to fix it. Don't even think that way. People say all the time to me, I just have no words. Of course you have no words, because there are no words. There's no words to fix it, no words to solve it. There's no words to make it better. Right? All there are words of comfort and love and have you there. That's what you do. For people who are grieving, you can't fix it. Don't try to, and don't think you can. Don't think you have to help them get past it. You don't. You don't have to worry about what they're feeling. Just be there, and just talk to them. And he says, it is a normal emotional process that people go through. Don't avoid them out of fear of bothering them any more than any other time. So I don't want to say you might never bother them, but it's no different for the person grieving than it is for anybody else. So if you're there, oh, I don't want to bother them. No, don't think that.
Bad thought. Call them, do whatever, do more. And they'll probably tell you if they can't.
Yep.
Doesn't fit. You know, not up to it, whatever. And be willing to accept that. But you're really not bothering them. And you're also not going to stop their grieving. You're not going to do much to their grieving, by the way, except just be there and express the connection that you have, and so that they don't fall into kind of a sinkhole of loneliness. Offer specific help. This is a big one, and I know a lot of you have given me general offers of, hey, if there's anything I need, just let you know. And so I've learned, talking even with other people, those are hard things to do anything with. And they're appreciated, and I know they're meant from the heart, and the thought is wonderful. But here's the thing that it does to somebody who is suffering. It places the burden of figuring out what you can do and what they need, putting it together in the time frame in order to ask you to do it. And very often, that process mentally is too hard. You need to simply offer specific help you can do. Because the truth is, if somebody comes up to me and says, hey, anything you need. So Ben comes up to me, anything I need. I really could use you to, you know, do my dishes for me or do my laundry. You want to take these bins of dirty clothes for me? Ben, have you done a thing of dirty clothes recently? Or is that mostly... Not recently, I'm guessing, yeah. Not that he couldn't figure it out, but I can figure it out as good as Ben. The truth is, one of us that goes, is anything you need? Well, it's not anything. There's only certain things you can do. There's only certain things that are within your capabilities and your opportunities and your time. And not everybody can do everything. It's like, I don't call up Janae and say, hey, Janae, I have this huge piece of furniture that I need you to move for me. She's not going to do that. She's, well, I could call Forrest. And maybe Ben. But the thing, it's tough for people. And this is something I've kind of experienced myself. And I've also talked with others in a bereavement group. And I've also, you know, read about it. That it is a common thing. Very often when people are really suffering, we make offers that do it in such a way that place the burden of your helping them on them. And it, an extra little burden is often still too much. And so the better thing to do is simply, if you have something you think might be helpful, just offer it. I was really thankful. I think it must have been, I don't know, Dondi, like a month or so ago, maybe just before Julie passed, asked me to offer to do my laundry. You know? Now, I think I had already pretty much just done it, so I had almost no laundry to do. And also, I felt a little weird about having, you know, underwear and stuff be handed off to a friend. But still, it was like, I really appreciated it, but I didn't need it. Thank you. But it was very specific, was a very specific thing to do, and it was very helpful. It was more helpful than just, hey, anything you need, let me know. Because I'm like, I don't know. Here's what happens in my brain, and in most of the people that I've talked with, they're like really in the middle of grief. They go, I don't know. That's the reaction. I really don't know. Because I can't think that. I can't think about tomorrow. I can't think about even a few hours from now sometimes. And you're just like, it just layers it. It's thoughtful, but not helpful. Hopefully that makes sense. And so the last one, understanding of what I talked about at the very beginning, it can be quite lonely, and you can't fix that. You will not, none of you will ever grieve for Julie the way I am, even Janae. Her and my grief, even though we are both there right to the end with her, it's not the same. She lost her mother. That's a uniqueness. I lost my wife. That's unique, right? And so sometimes what happens in families, by the way, and sometimes in the bereavement group, I even heard this. They said, other people, friends or family, would get upset that they weren't grieving right. Like me going, I can't understand why my mom's not over, you know, the loss of my sister or the loss of my nephew. Like, because it wasn't my daughter. And I didn't get that way back when. And so everybody will have their own time frame. Everybody have their own connection to her. And I know lots of you did as well. She was connected to all, you know, most of you in a lot of ways. And all yours is all going to be a little different too, and all unique. And none of us can feel it for the other. None of us can do anything about it, those feelings, except just try and be there and give them the presence with the C. So we'll end that there. Appreciate your time today. If you need something, we haven't really been talking about the plan of salvation, but our connection to love one another is central to everything God has done. Everything God teaches us is about loving one another. And you know what the cost of that is? Grief. We grieve God all the time. You know, God told them not to mourn over sinners sometimes, but God himself grieves over our sin. He sees us and the things we do, and he grieves, and it hurts him, like it does any parent when they see their children do things that bring them sorrow and pain. And so it really is central to the idea. God knows we are going to grieve. He understands it. That's why he bore all of our griefs upon his son, that he might wipe away all of our tears. And if you're here today and you hear this even at home, you know, shoot us a message, call us, you know, email us, grab somebody in our group, anybody, the elders, the deacons, just any member. If you need something, please reach out. We're going to go ahead and stand and sing.